Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health and North Florida TPO.
Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and this is First Coast Connect. Today, meeting the demand for both primary care doctors and subspecialty physicians, we talk with a recent med school graduate about the growing need in communities with health disparities. Later in the program, ancient tattoo art, current cultural events, and the cellist from one of Coldplay's biggest hits. But first, Saturday was graduation day for a new crop of Mayo Medical School graduates, coming in a time of looming doctor shortages and revolutions in healthcare. To discuss that, we're joined by Dr. Gerardo Colon Otero, medical oncologist who practices gynecological cancers, and Vice Dean of Mayo Clinic Alex School of Medicine. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you so much for having us.
Mouthful. I'm glad I got through it. And a recent medical school graduate, Dr. Yeonsu Sara-Lee, soon to be a practicing urological surgeon. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, not quite practicing, but excited to enter residency at Mayo Clinic for urology.
And that's a long process, as you were saying.
Yeah, it is. So
you just completed, and congratulations, you just graduated from medical school. But that goes, I mean, for people who aren't familiar, and I'm not all terribly familiar, you then go into this lengthy residency. What does that entail?
Yeah, absolutely. I wasn't familiar with it until I applied to medical school as well. But essentially, that's 4 years of college. I took some time in between because I wasn't pre-med in college, and then 4 years of medical school. And then depending on what specialty you choose, often between 3 to 7 years of training in your chosen specialty.
And you will be practicing urological surgery, which not a lot of women in that field. So how did you end up there yourself?
Yeah, I mean, kind of like I said, I didn't know very much about medicine until I started going into it. And I think that was a really interesting process and so much to learn about different specialties. So I came in with a really open mindset. I had worked in women's health before. I'd worked in infectious disease before medical school. So thought maybe I wanted to practice medicine, which is different in a lot of communities to surgery. But the first time I stepped into an operating room was basically in medical school. And I thought, what a special privilege to be able to care for patients using my own two hands, being able to see what's going on, kind of like being someone who sees a problem and fixes it in that moment. So then became curious about surgery, and there are whole fields dedicated to different types of surgery in different parts of the body. Obviously, we know about neurosurgery or cardiothoracic surgery, but there are other fields that are less well known, like ENT, which is ear, nose, and throat surgery, or urology, which is surgery in the urological organ system. So your kidneys, your bladders, your urethras, and that's not really talked about as much. So when I found out about this field, I thought, well, why don't people talk about it? And it was really interesting to me because it's kind of a taboo part of the body to talk about. And women aren't as well represented in this field. So that's kind of why I got interested.
You know, I recently interviewed another female urologist, and we were talking about just, you know, how unusual it is sometimes for a woman to be in that field. Why do you think that is? Is it because it's often thought of as, you know, your clientele is primarily male and maybe that's a little awkward?
Well, I think there are a couple of different factors. There are still fields in surgery where women are severely underrepresented, like orthopedic surgery or neurosurgery. And I think that certainly applies to urology as well. I think you kind of hit the nail on the head. A lot of people think of urology as a very male-dominated and male-treatment-based specialty. So there's definitely still that. And I think there's a little bit of a paradigm as well. There's gynecology, which is kind of the surgical counterpart to urology in terms of women's health. People often think that women will be treated in terms of urology-based conditions by gynecologists as well. And there's definitely some overlap there.
Interesting. So Dr. Colon Otero, I want to bring you in. The challenges of medical education today are really so varied, and a lot of them are quite difficult. I mean, there's an enormous amount of information out there in the world that's available. It would seem that going through medical school would get ever more complicated, ever longer. How does a medical school manage with their students to handle the volume of information and just the revolution in the availability of that information and the technology that's available?
You're absolutely right. Medical knowledge has increased dramatically, and with that, there's a need for more learning, and it's a challenge for medical school education to incorporate all those aspects that are needed to create a physician that will be able to be a competent physician. The medical education process, the medical school is just a part of it. As Sarah, for example, is going into residency to become a urologist, and as medicine has grown more and more, there's more and more subspecialization. So a lot of the knowledge that is acquired and the ability to care for patients and develop the dexterity in surgery and so forth is developed during residency. So we concentrate on the basic knowledge that the students need to become a physician, but a lot of the training into their subspecialty happens then during residency.
And so what is the greatest need right now in terms of the kind of physicians? We hear a lot about, you know, physician shortages, particularly, you know, with people who cater to perhaps, you know, geriatric populations, but also pediatrics to some extent. Where do you see the greatest need in terms of, you know, physician shortages?
Yeah, I think physician shortages exist for all specialties, not just primary care, but also all specialties. There are shortage. It's estimated in Florida, for example, that by 2030, there will be a 22,000 shortage of number of physicians that are needed for serving our aging population and the population that is increasing in Florida. So as medicine has progressed, there's more and more subspecialty and more need for subspecialists as well. So there's a need for primary care, particularly in rural areas, and also specialty care in all areas, including urology. And as Sarah mentioned, there are some areas in medicine and surgery in particular where there's significant underrepresentation of female physicians too.
And so why is it that there is a physician shortage? I mean, I think obviously there's a lot of costs associated with medical school. Is that the primary hurdle? Because, I mean, it's a very respected, you know, tradition, profession. I would think it would draw a lot of people.
Yes, and there's a lot of interest and a lot of applicants to medical school, and not all students who want to become physicians are able to get into medical school and get a medical school education. A part of this shortage, I think, happens at the level of the residency or what we call graduate medical education. There's probably a need for more positions in graduate medicine, more residency positions, so that the students can then become family physicians, internal medicine doctors, pediatricians, and subspecialists. So there's a need for that in the state of Florida and throughout the country.
You mean that students who graduate from medical school, there isn't availability for them to be residents to kind of have that next step?
The positions are available, and most of them end up matching at a residency through a matching program. And there are international graduates who also compete for those positions. And last year, 50% of the international graduates were able to get a residency positions. But when you look at the physicians' needs for the next 10, 20 years, there will be a need for more of those residency positions, and as well as a more need for medical school students.
But I guess I'm not clear. What do you think explains the shortage? Is it that people aren't able to get into medical school just because of the academic side, or they're not able to get in because financially? Or
I think there's need for more medical schools or medical school medical positions for medical students, but then also a need for more residencies as well.
And perhaps that shortage is also driven by the fact that our population is aging and that people get sicker as they get older.
That's correct. Yeah, there's more need for more physicians as the population ages. So there's a need for more physicians coming into the pipeline.
Dr. Lee, you said that you had some background in women's health, but you also had some background in public health and the needs of underserved communities. You did some work abroad. Tell us a little bit about how you came into this, what that work was and how that sort of steered where you ended up.
Yeah, absolutely. I mentioned earlier that I wasn't a pre-med student in college. And during that time, I actually studied disease ecology or ecology and evolutionary biology. Thought I wanted to become a fieldwork researcher. So going out into the field, the rivers, the lakes, collecting my own samples and doing kind of environmentally science-based research. So I've always had a love for asking questions, trying to use my own hands to figure out the answers. And when I graduated from college, I took a research fellowship and I did that in Brazil. In the Northeast in a place called Salvador. And it was really beautiful. I learned a lot. And essentially the goal there was to go and understand disease burden or how much disease there was of a specific type of rat-borne illness, leptospirosis. So if malaria is carried by mosquitoes or leptospirosis is carried by rats. And in that area, unfortunately, because of socioeconomic reasons, there were also lots of rats. And so I got there and I started studying the amount of bacteria carried by those rats in rivers, in sewage, in dirt, in rainwater, and was really enjoying like the ability to understand the intersection of public health and medicine and environmental science. But once I got there, people kept on asking me questions like I was a doctor because I was wearing a lab coat. And you had to do that because people needed to recognize that you were a scientist when you were entering those areas. Otherwise, a foreign face could be like a source of suspicion. And people would be like, hey, doc, do you know what to do about this? My grandma's not doing super well. And obviously, I had no idea. And so I wasn't going to answer any of those questions, but kind of planted the seed. I'm here doing research and I love doing it and it satisfies my curiosity, but what am I going to do with it? So when I asked some of my research advisors, hey, do you have any advice on how I can translate some of the research I'm doing to actual care for humans? My research advisor was an MD, PhD, and he said, well, you should consider getting an MD. It will give you the power and the skills to be able to do the research that you want to do, but it sounds like you want something a little bit more hands-on. So that's kind of the tie or the draw to medicine for me.
And did your counselor say, P.S., that's 8 more years of school?
No, they didn't, but I think I felt really well supported during that time. And I've always been kind of a believer of, even if it takes a really long time, as long as I'm enjoying the process, it's just another way to learn.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about meeting the needs in communities with health disparities. You can join our conversation live on air by calling 904-549-2937. You can also email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, or you can reach out on social media. Dr. Colin Otero, the Mayo has sort of an interesting model for medical school. Dr. Lee just graduated from the Florida campus, as it were, but it requires a bit of exploration at other Mayo facilities. Tell us about that arrangement and why is that?
Yes, the Mayo Clinic Alex School of Medicine is a national school with 3 campuses. So students who are interested in studying medicine at Mayo apply to the medical school. And they express their interest into which of the 3 campuses they would like to matriculate. So those who choose Florida as their number one choice, those applications are reviewed by a Florida committee, and they're interviewed here and selected here. We usually get about 500, 600 applications for 12 slots. Mm-hmm. This is in its 7th year right now for the Florida campus. Nationally, we get about 5,000 applicants to all 3 campuses. So the students who are selected to the Florida campus spend their first 18 months, 24 months in Arizona or Minnesota, and they then move to Florida to complete their medical education, and they graduate from our Florida campus. So we just celebrated our 3rd graduation with Sarah's class this year.
This last weekend. And so what does that kind of split facility model bring to students?
So the student, Sarah, for example, spent her first 2 years in Arizona, in the Arizona campus. So the students are exposed to different communities and learn from, they benefit from the national stature of Mayo Medical School. So at, In Florida, we have 1,000 full-time faculty and residents and fellows. The same number in Arizona, in Minnesota, about 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 full-time faculty and fellows. So they get exposed to different communities too. In Florida, we partner with the excellent health systems that are in Florida, including Baptist, Wolfson, Nemours Children's, the Navy Hospital. So they get exposed to different environments and different populations, and that just strengthens their medical education.
I want to ask you a little bit about the research that you do, because your work is in gynecological cancers.
Right.
But you've been working on some new drug combinations. Talk a little bit about what has been effective, what trends you are seeing in those kinds of cancers and their survivability.
I've been practicing for 38 years, so I've seen the huge improvement we have noticing cancer in general. In gynecological cancers, there's still a lot of need, but there has been great improvement. So ovarian cancer, for example, the average survival exceeds 5 years now, which was not the case 30 years from ago. And there's a lot of new developments, particularly related to the immunology of ovarian cancer, including development of vaccines and new immune-based treatment. And the same is true for endometrial cancers and cervical cancers. So there's a lot of hope for the next 10 or 20 years that we're going to find more and more cures for these diseases.
And why is it that ovarian cancer is so lethal? I mean, kind of think of it on par with pancreatic cancer in terms of just being a death sentence.
So it's in part is because of the fact that when it's diagnosed, usually it's advanced stage because of where the ovaries are. But there's very effective therapy, and cure has occurred or can occur in as many as 50% or more now compared to 20, 30 years ago, where that number may have been 10% or less.
I was on your Mayo site, and I saw something that really just kind of stopped me in my tracks, because it seemed more frank and unvarnished than you hear perhaps from your own physician. But it said, all patients with breast cancer and gynecologic cancer that has spread eventually die of their cancer.
Not all of them. We do cure some of them, but many of them, unfortunately. So there's a lot of need for additional research for breast cancer, ovarian cancer, gynecological cancer, and all other cancers.
But ultimately, you're looking at kind of a delay in the lethality of the metastatic cancers.
No, actually, we do cure some patients who have widely metastatic ovarian cancer and breast cancer with the newer treatments that are available. So we always give that hope to the patients, because that's a real thing. They can be cured.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about environmental causes for that. And I would like to hear from Dr. Lee as well, but particularly for some of those gynecological cancers, we hear about environmental causes, whether it's, you know, disrupted hormones because of pollutants in the environment. Recently, there was a lot of news about baby powder perhaps being a contributor to ovarian cancers. Do you see much in the way of where finding a more specific reason that those cancers occur?
So for ovarian cancer, we know there's a significant genetic component. And in terms of what environmental factors are playing a role, we still don't have a clear idea. There's controversy about talc, whether it can had contributed to ovarian cancer or doesn't.
Like in talcum powder.
Talc powder use. But there's a lot of research going on and a lot of development that has had a huge impact on ovarian cancer. So.
And Dr. Lee, since you came at science from an environmental perspective, how do you see that conversation now that you're, you know, on the medical side? Do you see much interaction between the world of environmental research and the world of medicine?
Yeah, I can't comment specifically on environmental contributors to gynecologic illness, but I think that's a trend that I've seen in lots of research in different areas. For example, in urology, there's a lot of study of how someone's gut microbiome or microbiome might be able to influence some disease processes. So I think there's definitely interplay, and there's like the study of epigenetics as well. So how the environment or someone's circumstances might influence your genetics and have that be passed on. I think that's definitely an area of research that a lot of people are interested in.
And so tell us a little bit about your days now as you move forward into your residency. We always hear about long hours, kind of crazy round the clock. Is that accurate? Is that what you're going to be living now?
Well, for now, I was telling Dr. Colon Otero, I have a little bit of vacation, which is insane. I don't know what to do with all this time. But beginning June 24th, July 1st, I'll be starting residency. The hours are pretty variable depending on what service I'll be on. So if you watch Grey's Anatomy, I know people rotate on different services like cardiothoracic surgery or the intensive care unit. So Grey's Anatomy isn't completely right in that I won't be rotating through services that aren't pertinent to my training, but the hours are pretty intense. The governing board for residency, however, has recently set a limit in terms of workable hours, so we won't be working around the clock like some former physicians may have.
Yeah, and so what are reasonable hours? What is the definition under that new established guideline? Yeah,
I believe it's under 80 hours per week, and that's still a lot of hours, but I think I've always thought that sometimes you need to get the repetitions in order to see the dividends, and that's definitely true in surgery, which is a physical act. So 80 hours or less.
And so how long is it before you actually are able to wield a scalpel?
Day one. So under supervised practice, you're allowed to help participate or help assist in surgery even beginning in your clinical years in medical school. So if I feel ready and if my preceptors or the doctors I'm working with feel that I'm ready and have demonstrated the capability and the knowledge, they'll let me start helping on day one.
Is that nerve-wracking for you personally?
It's nerve-wracking. It's a massive responsibility, but it's also really exciting because this is what I've been waiting and training and studying for.
And Dr. Colon Otero, how do you help somebody like Dr. Lee make that transition from, you know, exploring all of this from a purely academic side to really being in the field with patients, before you?
Yeah, that's a great question. So as part of the medical school training, they actually are exposed to patient care early on. And as medical school curriculum has changed over the years, we expose them earlier. And we make sure that by the time they finished their medical school, they had all those experiences. We use simulation. We had a fantastic simulation center at our medical school where they practice using fresh cadavers and cadavers. It's not like when they are resident, they haven't been exposed or they haven't done surgery or participated in surgery. So they are well-trained as it relates to all that. And part of their training is actually related to doing preparation for residency. So where they're actually functioning as an intern already or functioning as a resident during the last year. And that sort of prepares them perfectly for the residency.
Do you look at these new guidelines that limit some of the hours that they have in residency? Do you think that this new crop is just going to be soft because you had to do so much more?
No, I think they are very appropriate to have those guidelines so that they are rested. But there's no question residency is a very taxing procedure because they get to work extremely hard and taking care of the patients under supervision, which is great.
Well, Dr. Colon Otero and newly minted Dr. Lee, thank you both so much for being here today. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
And good luck with everything. Up next, a form of indigenous tattooing that goes far more than skin deep. Welcome back. Well, we're going to be talking now about the ancient art of batok.
Is it correct?
Thank you. A Philippine art form, ancient and really revered to talk about it. I've got Grace Bio. She's a Filipino-American graphic designer and illustrator and muralist from Jacksonville. Welcome.
Thank you.
And CJ Bautista, Jacksonville visual artist and photographer. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. So tell us, first of all, just what is batok tattooing?
So batok is a pre-colonial form of tattooing in the Philippines. It dates back to the early 1500s. And due to Spanish colonization, it was on the brink of extinction. So there was a Filipino tattoo artist around the world that grew an interest to it. So they decided to go back to the Philippines and learn under different practitioners in the Philippines to learn the indigenous way.
I saw that there was a quote that the Spaniards, after colonizing the islands, they had called it Las Islas de los Pintados, the islands of the painted ones, which is fascinating. And so this is a specifically kind of an indigenous Filipino tradition.
Correct. Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so what is the significance, CJ, of the tattoos for people? What do they symbolize?
They symbolize different things. Sometimes it symbolizes rank. Sometimes it symbolizes achievement. Sometimes it symbolizes family storage and lineage. It could also symbolize, sometimes it could also just be for beauty, beautification.
Yeah. And does it symbolize anything about the people in the culture prior to colonization?
Yeah, it has to do with, like, so there's actually different tribes throughout the Philippines that have different design motifs that pertain to that particular tribe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so the tradition, describe a little bit about how it's different from typical tattooing that we think of.
Yes.
So batok, if you're familiar with tattooing, it's actually more traditional in the sense that it's a stick and poke style. That's what it was done before machine tattoos. So people would use natural instruments, usually something like a thorn or sharpened wood, to actually tap the ink into the skin. So that's how it was done originally before modernization.
Mm-hmm. And what was the ink made of?
So the ink was actually scraped from the bottom of earthenware. It, as you know, it creates a natural charcoal. And back in that time, they mixed it in combination with water or some sort of juice from different fruits that was in the area. And it kind of makes like a thicker ink. And yeah, they just kind of put it in a bowl, mix it up, and they tap it into the thorn or whatever needle that they have.
So tell us what a mamba batok is.
Mamba batok is the tattoo practitioner.
Okay. So that's anybody that is making these kinds of tattoos.
Mm-hmm.
And are they required to use kind of the ancient tools? Do they make their own tools?
It's a combination of both.
Mm-hmm. And so we saw recently there's this 106-year-old Filipino woman who was on the cover of Vogue.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. It is just an extraordinary image.
Yes.
First of all, she's just so beautiful, but yes, second of all, she's completely covered in these tattoos. We'll post a picture of her on our Facebook and our Instagram at FCC On Air so people can see it. But tell us a little bit about her and the significance of having her on the cover of Vogue.
Okay, so her name is Apple Wang Odd. She is from the Butbut tribe in Kalinga, Buscalon. And she's actually 107 years old. And so she's significant because in that region, that form of tattooing was on the brink of extinction, and she was the last person that was doing it. But because most recently she became a national treasure of the Philippines, people have literally traveled from all around the world to go see her. And yeah, now she's famous and people are really fond of the art form.
So we should say we're talking about this because you are hosting an event that's going to feature someone doing this kind of tattooing.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us about the event, first of all. Who is going to be receiving tattoos? Is it the kind of event where people can go and get tattoos?
Okay. So first of all, it is a tattoo-based event, but we're looking at this more as a cultural event in honor of AAPI Month. And
Tell us what that is.
Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month. There is a practitioner that is in California, coming from Southern California. His name is Francisco San Diego. And he's actually training a local Filipino tattoo artist here. It's a friend of ours, Trish Ann Padilla. And because of that apprenticeship, we thought would be a great idea to go ahead and make an event out of it. So he's going to come here. He's going to do a demonstration and talk on it. And we've also like to showcase other Filipino-American tattoo artists in the community. And we also have going on a visual art show. And we're setting it up as we speak at the moment. It looks amazing. We asked the artist to provide art which is inspired by either tattoo or pre-colonial Philippines.
Oh, fascinating. And so who gets these tattoos? Is it something that really is just almost proprietary, that it's done for and by people of Filipino descent?
Yeah, so back in the day, you had to earn the tattoos, but because of the modern way of tattooing, Mamba Batoks do prefer you to be of Filipino descent, but they're kind of opening that venue for anybody to explore their ancestry, especially like if you're with a Filipino, they kind of like merge their ancestry with the Filipino tribal designs.
Mm-hmm. And I see you have ink on your arm. Do either of you have one of these tattoos?
Great. I do.
Okay. And so tell us about the experience of getting that.
This is a really cool story of how I received this. So this was done by Lane Wilkin. He wrote a book called Filipino Tattoos. It's the first of its kind. And he took the whole trek to go to the Philippines to learn under different practitioners himself. And he brought it back to his respective homes. And he's in Las Vegas and Hawaii. And now he's literally traveling all around the world to do batok.
So describe, because people can't see necessarily in the radio, but describe the tattoo, what it looks like and what it symbolizes.
Okay, so the tattoo I have, it is four triangles, and it has four triangles on the inside that are filled, and it's a straight line. But what this represents is, so in pre-colonial times, there was these revered, commonly women called Babalans, and they were chieftains, they were leaders of their tribes, they were shamans, they were healers. And so apparently when the Spanish came, they were threatened by these Babalans, and sorry to be graphic, but they murdered them in a gruesome way, and they fed them to the crocodiles. And the triangles represent the back of the crocodile back, and Filipinos believe that the Babalan spirit is in all crocodiles. So this means that my ancestors are always with me.
Is the location of it significant at all? And are there any kind of guidelines or traditions when it comes to where tattoos are placed?
Yes. So apparently back in that time, it represented like, depending on the position on the body, it represented a social status or an achievement. Like for the men, when they're tattooed on the chest, they were known as headhunters, and it's pretty much self-explanatory, where they beheaded their enemies, and because of that, they protected their tribes, so they earned that chest tattoo. And when it came to women, they mainly got their upper arms tattooed. And that represented that they were ready for marriage, or they're ready to be fertile.
Okay. And for you personally?
For me personally, I told Lane that I wanted to activate my creative hand, which is my right hand. And this was for me to seamlessly create. And I swear to God, ever since I got this tattoo, I feel like this force around me when I create. Like my ancestors are surrounding me and upholding me as I create.
You have a regular administered tattoo as well. So how do they compare the experience?
Oh, God. It's significantly different. So for me, batok was very gentle. It actually did not hurt up until he started tattooing the sides of my arm. However, in contrast, when it comes to machine tattoos, it was brutal the whole time. You can ask CJ, he was there when I got it. I was sweating the whole time. I was in complete pain. So personally, I prefer batok.
Is it something that you're interested in, CJ, in getting one?
Absolutely, definitely. I mean, I've gotten several tattoos, as you can see, but I don't have the batok yet. Haven't had the opportunity for a practitioner readily available. I'm not able to travel. But with Francisco coming from California, we do have an appointment set up for the both of us.
Oh, terrific. Okay. Mm-hmm. Do you know what kind of symbol you're going to get and where you're going to get it?
So Filipino tattooing is very interesting. It's actually very spiritual in nature. So Mamba Batuks usually have a consultation with their client. They ask them their background, where their parents are from, something personal about them. And believe it or not, the tattoo designs are psychically channeled to them. So whatever you receive that's directly from spirit or your ancestors.
So you just get what you get.
You get what you get.
Sometimes it's like that, yes. I mean, you can also have some input, of course, but for the most part, the practitioner decides what you get. It's a very spiritual ceremony. It's not just like jumping into a tattoo shop and getting some flash. It's mm-hmm. very different.
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. super interesting. And so Grace, do other events that are mm-hmm. focused on Filipino-American community here mm-hmm. in Jacksonville. Mm-hmm. Why is it important to you to kind of make that community more visible or celebrate it in different ways?
Well, to be transparent, for a long time, especially as a visual artist in Jacksonville, I didn't see enough representation for the AAPI community or Filipinos. So I kind of sought different sources and organizations that did that type of work, and I volunteered my time and my gifts to make sure that we were uplifted in any way that I could. So pretty recently, I'd say last year, that I was granted the opportunity to be a curator of an all-Filipino art exhibit. And that was kind of like my first time uplifting other Filipinos in the community.
Yeah. Well, we appreciate your work. It's really great that you're going to bring this amazing art form to Jacksonville. It's this Saturday, May 25th from 3 to 8 p.m., it's at Jacksonville Piercing and Tattoo on 8th Street.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
CJ Grace, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Happy to be here.
And stick around. We'll be right back with the week's hottest cultural events. Welcome back. Well, we're heading into the Memorial Day weekend, a three-day weekend for some of us. And I'm joined now by Yaya Cardona of Create Jax. Did we bring our little buddy today?
Yes, he is. He's hiding in his bag.
Oh.
Buenos dias, mi gente, from Yaya and Little Mambo. We're excited to be here today to let you guys know all the amazing things that are happening around our city. Did you know that this week is Tourism Week?
I do. You know, I actually talked to somebody from Visit Jacksonville earlier this
week. So, I'm really excited. So I just posted a really cool reel of all my favorite restaurants, events, all nightlife. So check it out. Check out my Instagram page. Yeah, I love Jax. We got to give love to our city. Jacksonville's a tourism destination.
Hey, man, as long as Mambo's in those, I'm down.
You know what I'm saying? Bueno, mi gente, we're going to go ahead and read the list of Create Jax so you guys can know what's happening here in the 904. You can follow us on our website on createjax.com. That's CREJax.com. And bueno, let's talk about the nation's oldest continuously operating dinner theater. Do you know that that's here in Jacksonville?
The longest, the Alhambra.
Yeah, the Alhambra Theater. I did not know that. That is the nation's oldest.
It's extraordinary. Yeah. Dinner theater, and they do a really nice, varied thing. I mean, they're always cranking out really different kinds of productions.
Yeah, well, I love it. My mom loves it because you get to see a show and dinner. So this weekend, they have the show opening of Boeing. Boeing is a new play that just opened and is set in the swinging 60s with the ladies man who's juggling three fiancés. That's too much, honey. All right, so check that out. That's going to be playing this whole weekend, and it's going to be running through June 16th.
And then this weekend, we can't ignore it because it's literally outside our door and in our hallway.
It's literally in your backyard right here on WJCT.
Jazz Fest.
Bueno, it's the Jacksonville Jazz Fest. Yes, it's been, it's coming this weekend. For free, mi gente, yes. This is a festival that's been happening since 1980. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it has gone through a lot of changes, a lot of different locations, but this year it's returning home to Metro Park, which is, you know, kind of its ancestral home, I would think.
Yes.
Who is going to be playing?
We have several great performances. We have the Stanley Clark Band, Joss Stone, and one of my favorite, Robin Thicke. Lost without you. I'm excited about this.
Nice.
This is a festival that's happening this whole entire weekend. It's free and open to the public. On Saturday and Sunday, the hours run from 3 to 11 p.m. And be sure to arrive early because parking might be tight.
And it will be tight, but it is free, which is pretty nuts.
It is free. And remember, we have other services. If you don't feel like driving, use Uber. We have all these cool scooters that you could drive. You could park in downtown and scoot your way down here. You know, there's all these cool ways to come over here. So check that out. Oh, yeah, I need to talk about moving the margins. We have an exhibit opening this Saturday from 5 to 9 p.m. completely free. The exhibit opening is with Sarah Crooks. It's a mythopoetic stories of transformation model empathy while shifting our culture of domination to reciprocity.
Reciprocity, my friend.
Reciprocity. You know, you guys know Hooked on Phonics didn't work for me, okay? English is my second language. So check that out, Moving the Margins this Saturday from 5 to 9 p.m. Now, I want to talk about Memorial Day Observation and Parade.
All right.
There's a Memorial Day honors those who lost their lives while serving in the military. The city honors them with an observance at the Jacksonville Veterans Memorial Wall beginning at 8:30 a.m. The tribute includes music by Navy Southeast Band and remarks by retired Navy Vice Admiral Mary Jackson. At the Jacksonville National Cemetery, volunteers will place flags on each of 22,000 graves.
It's a big event. It's reason for the long weekend. And we're going to have to leave it there. Yaya Cardona, thank you so much for being here.
So check it out. Follow Create Jackson. Follow me on Instagram. Yaya Love Jax. Have a good weekend.
All right. Stick around. We'll be back with the cellist from one of Coldplay's biggest hits.
Mayo Clinic, working to predict the unpredictable by using a patient's anatomy to create 3D printed life-size organ models to map out complex surgeries. More at mayoclinic.org/Florida.
North Florida TPO, proud sponsor of WJCT's First Coast Connect, bringing to the community innovation in transportation planning, commuter services, clean fuels, and intelligent transportation systems. More at northfloridatpo.com.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Each week on The Middle, we're live and taking your calls about the big issues, focusing on getting away from the extremes and elevating voices from the middle. Next time, what does Memorial Day mean to you? And do you spend time thinking about our fellow citizens who have made the ultimate sacrifice? I'll be joined by a former U.S. Secretary of Veterans Affairs and a Gold Star mom. Next time on The Middle.
Tonight at 9, here on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, an inside look at a corruption scandal that rocked the U.S. Navy. Journalist Craig Whitlock tells the story of a colorful Malaysian businessman and defense contractor who plied Navy commanders with lavish meals, trips, cash, and sex workers. In return, they let him overcharge taxpayers and make millions. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
In a scientific first this year, two living patients have been implanted with genetically engineered pig kidneys. We sit down with a doctor who performed the first of these experimental surgeries and the CEO of a company breeding the genetically engineered pigs. But even as roughly 13 people die daily waiting for a new kidney, some question that pigs are the best way to get more organs. The fight to solve the kidney shortage. Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
And we're back. Well, you may well recognize that song as Viva La Vida by Coldplay, and those instantly recognizable strings at the beginning are played by my guest and cellist composer David Egger. Welcome.
Thank you, Anne. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, welcome back. So you're in town tonight with your own band, Bristol Lightning, but you've also worked with Beyonce, Taylor Swift, John Legend, Tony Bennett, so many others.
Yeah, I mean, before the pandemic, I was touring with a lot of different artists. And then when the world shut down, one thing that was really interesting was that my roommate from New York, Phil Ficanti, moved to Bristol, Tennessee. And we started doing orchestration remotely for all sorts of artists. And it's been a really, really fun time working with Louis Capaldi and John Legend. And our own record got two Grammy nominations last year, and all from a little town in Tennessee. And tonight we're bringing Bristol Lightning, which is a really unique blend of classical music, blues, rap, and bluegrass to Friday Musicale. And we're really excited to bring the flavors of Bristol, which is the birthplace of country music, and also our New York City, kind of bringing that rural and urban flavor together.
And not to, elide your amazing work recently, but you were playing cello since age 3. You were performing on Broadway at age 7.
I was.
And you're a student of Aaron Copland and Yo-Yo Ma. Yeah. Really have like extraordinary bona fides when it comes to music.
I appreciate that. I mean, I feel like I've been very lucky. I was mentored by some incredibly idealistic people that really gave me a deep love of storytelling in music, of integrity in music, and also to kind of cross borders. And, you know, we all can tell powerful stories together. And that's one of the parts of our sort of polystylism that I like to really bring to the table is that multiplicity of storytelling.
And so Bristol, I didn't realize this, where you live, it's actually a city that spans Tennessee and Virginia.
Yes.
What about the music that you're playing in Bristol Lightning kind of takes something from the musical tradition of that place?
I mean, yeah, in 1927, the Bristol sessions were kind of like the first country music recording sessions. And I've always been like, because of studying with Aaron Copland, I grew up in the tiny little town that he retired to, and I met him when I was 6, and he passed away when I was about 8 and a half. I've just always been really, you know, fascinated with folklore and folk music and kind of how unique instruments can be used. And so being that Bristol's the birthplace of country music, I've just loved this way that we're sort of taking bluegrass and telling fantastical stories with it that incorporate classical music and now hip hop with our rapper Liasha Julius. And we have Liasha here with us today and Jamie Collins, who's our bluegrass singer, and very exciting for us.
And so Jamie's on bass and Liasha is a vocalist, and you're going to be performing for us here. Tell us about the song. It's called
Someday. Yeah. And this is a song actually from an upcoming record of Jamie's, and we just sort of fused it with some specialness from our new Bristol Lightning EP. It's sort of a mashup. And Someday, I believe, Jamie, was originally a eulogy, right? For who was it for? For Olive Stockton. And then Tim Stafford from Blue Highway and Jamie turned it into this unique song. So
beautiful. Well, Dave Egger, Jamie Collins, Liasha Julius, thank you all so much for being here, and we'll let you play us out. That's our program. We encourage your feedback and suggestions, and you can send either to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. If you missed anything, you can catch our rebroadcast at 8 o'clock or find our entire archive at WJCT.org or on your favorite podcast platform. Join us tomorrow when our panel of journalists talks about the latest headlines, including a new Duval superintendent and concerns about yet another JEA's chief departure. I'm Ann Schindler. You've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Someday when my last line is written, Someday when I've drawn my last breath, when my last words on earth have been spoken, and my lips are sealed in death, don't look on my cold form in pity. Don't think of me as one dead. It'll just be the house I once lived in. My spirit, my then will have fled.
Leaving on a jet plane, gotta fly, gotta hop on the next train. Can I ride southbound to the mountainside? Gotta drive, I'm headed for the south side, I'm running. Back roads running, I'm running, ground burning. I feel the heat on my feet, I'm burning. South side calling to me, I'm yearning. Missing my home in the trees and my peeps with a beer in the back of the Jeep. And my man on the porch with cigar and a drink. Music will get the folks out of their seat. Get so lit, I lose count of the sheep. Lordy, have mercy, lordy, lordy. Get baptized, Lord, return me to the water. Going south side so my roots get stronger. Ain't got a dime, anybody got a quarter? Ah.
I'll have finished my time here allotted, but I won't be in darkness alone. I will have heard from heaven the summons to come on home. And when my body is in the grave, don't think that I'll be there. I won't be dead but living in the place Jesus went to prepare. And after all is said and done, know that my last earnest prayer is that my loved ones be ready.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.